Hey guys, there are Star Wars spoilers in this podcast. It's about the last 10 minutes starting at the 50-minute mark. Consider yourself warned.
Hello, fellow kids, and welcome to a special year-end edition of The Reason podcast, where myself, Matt Welch, the point guard, and the various wingmen and centers of The Reason editorial staff, including Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangu-Ward, Peter Suderman, chew upon the news this time of the year. We're going to look back at 2017, what went right, what went wrong, how we all aged. Before we reflect on all of that, a reminder, please go on iTunes, subscribe to us. It's very easy. And then write a little review of us, a year-end view, our annual review. Go ahead and put that in there, how we did, and rate us too. Preferably with high stars, but you know, be honest with yourself. Anyways, so we're recording this and releasing this on the eve of Festivus, which, from what I understand from Nick Gillespie, refers to the TV show Seinfeld, like about half of his jokes do. And it's the special year-end airing of the grievances and other things. So, in that spirit, we're going to look back and see what we want to air our grievances about in terms of the progress of human freedom in this past year. And I just sort of to set the stage for our mindset here, I would recall the sort of Twitter meme of this is what I look like at the beginning of 2017. And this is what I look like, this haggard husk at the end of 2017, and throw it open first to Catherine Mangu-Ward. Did you start 2017 as a bright eyed, fresh cheeked young lassie and are now an aging, decrepit grandmother? Or how did this year treat the editor in chief of Reason Magazine?
I mean, I would put it back 2 years. I think I was Cindy Lou Who 2 years ago. As we wind up 2017, I'm the Grinch. You know, that's okay. I think probably the Grinch is the one who's right about human nature, not Cindy Lou Who, that tiny, cheerful idiot.
But we're supposed to be optimists, Catherine, here. Libertarianism is a positive view of the future.
Okay, I can be an optimist. So this was a hell of a year for ladies, man. And I'm a lady. So that's good, I guess.
Wow. So we're starting off on a very depressed note here. Peter Suderman, did you age 17 dog years throughout 2017 as the politics and culture and life tumbled forth?
I think I left the dog aging to my dog, who aged one human year, but I'm not sure how many dog years.
He's seven.
He's kind of like, he's seven, whatever it is. He's settled into a kind of early middle-aged, and he and I really get along in a new way right now. It's kind of amazing. I feel like we're both, like, this is the point in his life where he is the equivalent age to me. And so we just kind of relate. We hang out, we drink beer, we play video games, you know, sit on the couch a lot, like occasionally go for nice walks. I'm not really sure why I'm talking about my dog right now. It was a good year for him. It was a good year for him. And at the beginning of the year, I was like a smoldering fire Balrog. At the beginning of the year, at the beginning of the year, I was like the Incredible Hulk. And now I feel a little bit more like Bruce Banner.
That's good.
And but Bruce Banner, after he's been through some really bad Hulk shit, right? And so he's just like lying in a pile of like tattered purple sweatpants and being kind of exhausted.
You gotta love the purple pants. The Hulk, wow. He was styling.
Wow.
No, because when Trump won last year, I was thinking about this just yesterday. Trump won just over a year ago, and he hadn't become president, you know, as of January 1st of last year. But we knew that it was going to happen. The transition had already started. And I was upset. I had opposed Trump and thought he was not going to be a great president. But even more than that, I was just kind of, I couldn't see over the event horizon. I was really unclear about what a Trump presidency and a Trump America was going to look like. And now we know, and there are many things that I do not like about it. Many things I continue to strongly dislike Donald Trump and his close circle administration and a lot of the ways that he runs things. On the other hand, America is kind of doing fine. Like, we may be
USA.
On the precipice of disaster at any moment, but we hulked out, you know, or I did anyway, and now we can just sort of, like, take a moment to sit in our sweatpants pile and kind of like and breathe deep a little bit and go, okay, you know, we made it through that.
Nick, how are your sweatpants in 2017?
You know what? I lost a little bit of weight, so I can wear regular pants, you know? The
unlike Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Bill O'Reilly, you know, he had a tough 2017 because he somehow claimed that in order to save money and cheat customers, that clothiers were now, using less material. So you got to order a size up, as if that doesn't mean that they're still making the same amount of using the same amount of fabric. They just call it different. But here, I'll
also, doesn't it strike you as weird that a guy who makes like $30 million a year isn't getting custom tailoring?
Well, it's also because he makes $30 million, but then he pays out $31 million. You know, at this point, he's going to be broke in another, you know, 3 or 4 months.
See previous comments about it being a good year for ladies.
Absolutely, which I hope we'll get into when we're talking more generally about politics. But here is, you know, when Trump was elected, you know, that's you know, it's a big deal. I mean, and it's kind of, I dislike Trump as much as anybody on this call. And yet I think less than a lot of the people on this call, and certainly among my friends and whatnot, I didn't see it as the apocalypse. I really do see it as it is the final act of revelation. But it means we're leaving all of that behind and we're going to get somewhere else. And I'll blather on about that later. For me, the paradigmatic moment of 2017 came in, I think it was late November, early December. And I was riding on a subway in New York and I was watching an Amazon streaming show on my Kindle HD Fire, which cost me like $70 and is an incredible tablet, super cheap. And I was watching a show and it was running out and we pulled into a station in on the subway train and I realized I needed like the next episode of a streaming thing. The signal, of course, in the New York City subway, they're supposed to have free Wi-Fi. It doesn't work. So I turned on my phone, turned it into a hotspot, tethered to it, downloaded an episode of Bosch, a very good Amazon original kind of L.A. noir show. I was downloading the episode while riding on a subway train, using my phone as the tethering device and watching the show even as it began downloading. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Like, you know, we are living in a world of wonders. And, you know, maybe we have to be underground so we don't think about Trump or the Democrats or Benghazi or, you know, Bill Clinton. But it's like it's, you know, there are amazing things going on. And if people actually think a little less about politics, and politics are important, that's what we write about 90% of the time. But it's like when you look at what's going on in the world, we're living in a world of wonders. And I'll pull age rank with Matt on this of, you know, we remember seeing things like the Bad News Bears in the movie theater. You know, we remember the bicentennial. There is no goddamn way that you could be looking forward to, you know, from that year to where we are in certain aspects, in vast aspects of globalization, of technology, of individual liberty. And you know what? It's like it's actually, you know, these are not the worst of times. They are certainly not the best of times, but they're pretty amazing times. And it's worth thinking about that in a larger global context than just whether or not Trump, you know, is a spaz who can't type, you know, and has bad spelling and bad grammar.
We got to Bad News Bears super fast in this podcast.
It's a special year-end retrospective, so we're going to hit on a lot of touchstones. I presume that Suderman has been using Jedi mind waves already that sensitive-eared listeners can hear. I'd just piggyback on that point before throwing it back out. There was an aging Slate writer whose name I'm blanking on, Timothy something maybe. Anyways, a couple of days back on the Twitter streams, he was like, 1968 was a really, really bad year. You know, we had these assassinations, we had other things. But 2017, maybe it's worse. And it's like, no, my God, have you ever looked at 1968, which is an important year because obviously I was born in 1968. And so is Reason. We'll both turn 50. Next year, 1968 sucked so bad. More U.S. soldiers died in 1968 in Vietnam than have died combined in all of our subsequent wars, just to throw one thing out there. You know, there were riots in scores, not just like a handful, but scores of cities across America after the assassination of Martin Luther King. You could see this stuff from space for decades afterwards, just like the carnage in Washington, D.C., you know, on 14th Street and U Street, which now is like the most happening and expensive place in the world.
And violent crime went down again this year. Yeah. Now, and there was a riot at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
A terrible, awful, awful, just a soul-crushing riot. My sociology professor in college, his hands were permanently disfigured from getting hit on the head with a truncheon in Chicago in 1968. That's not how things went down.
That doesn't sound like a true story.
It's absolutely true.
His hands, he got hit on the head and his hands were disfigured, Matt?
Yeah, he suffered nerve damage.
The story has fallen apart as you tell it.
No, check it out. Richard Flax.
I'm going to go get I'm going to FOIA the medical records. I think it is important to note how much less social unrest we see, even in these sort of times that feel quite politically turbulent, than in, you know, the late 60s and through the 70s. On the other hand, we also had, you know, the protests in Virginia, and we had a president who was completely unable to respond to them in a way that was presidential at all. And so I'm, you know, this is in some ways why my calmness, or sort of my sense that America is doing okay right now, and even pretty well in a lot of ways, is tempered by this like nagging risk that we have a president who, if there were a real crisis and a real emergency where we needed somebody who was
competent, what do we need him for? But what do we? I agree with you, Peter. But
well, to stay out of war with North Korea, for one thing.
He is not going to be able to do that. He can't even keep transgender soldiers out of his army. I'm not minimizing what you're talking about, because Trump is a problem. There is no question about that. But I think what we need to do, and especially if we want to be kind of optimistic, you know, happy warriors about the future and about libertarian ideas, we also need to take the offensive here and say, you know what, Trump is destroying the certainly any pretense to majesty of the presidential office in a way that Barack Obama, for all of his policy stupidities, did not do, in a way George Bush did not do. But let's work with that. And say, you know what, Trump didn't cause the alt-right, you know, celebration that killed somebody and injured people in Charlottesville, Virginia. And he's not going to be able to fix it either. And we need to, you know, as people, we need to be pushing forward on every lever that we have, including forcing Congress to actually do its job and to rein in a president, you know, et cetera. Like if we stay focused on Trump, we will all be, particularly in negative ways or in apocalyptic ways, the next 3 years are going to be hell and whatever happens after that. But we don't have to do that. We can keep him in check while getting on with the good things that are happening and making more of that happen.
So we've already...
You know who totally did that? Ladies. Yeah. Can we talk about that?
Talk about the ladies, Catherine.
Well, is this...
So the year starts...
Wait, are we going through... I thought we were going to talk about what was the big story of the year and everything, Matt.
This was the segue.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask
did you
us.
See how
okay,
I'm,
yeah, no, go.
Did you see how I just smoothly segued
you know,
into that
I
thing?
Didn't recognize it because you were a lady. I apologize. Please go. The story is ladies.
Yeah. The story is ladies. So, right, we start out the year with a bunch of ladies in pink hats super pissed about Donald Trump. And then they were like, well, those marches were fun, but not useful, because that guy is still the president and is going to be for the rest of his term, regardless of how many hats we knit. And so I feel like, you know, there's a case to be made for the fact that some of that rage, grumpiness, activism got sublimated into, transmogrified into, Jedi mind tricked into the Me Too movement, right? Like, women were like, hold on, really? We're going to make this guy president? Fine. We can't get him because he's president now, but let's get the people like him that we can catch using private mechanisms. And lo and behold, Me Too.
These are not the harassers you're looking for?
Yeah, maybe. Or I don't know.
He's not the
harasser we were looking for.
So,
I mean, he is, but yeah. So I guess I think like that it's a pretty interesting example of taking what was essentially political rage and turning it into an actual useful private sector kind of individual decision-making social movement that became, I think, is at the moment mostly on balance still making the world a better place. Now, we can talk about the places where this is tipping over into, you know, warlock hunting, but it still was, I think, mostly an overly correction.
I agree with you. I agree with you, Catherine. And I think, you know, the most, you know, really, I hadn't quite thought about it in those terms of, you know, it starts, the year kicks off with the women's rally, and it's a explicitly political rally held in Washington. People who are, you know, people are being tried, you know, at various, for disrupting various inauguration events. That was probably the biggest and most well-attended protest. And I think you're right. It was sublimated, transmuted into something that is so much bigger than politics and will have a lasting effect. And I see it as the final act of a kind of feminist equalization and leveling of power in America, and which has a long way to go, but that was initiated really in the 70s and 80s and has already in many ways worked itself through the corporate workplace and a lot of other places, and now is coming to, you know, old hierarchical industries like the entertainment industry, like the restaurant industry, and like politics. Matt, you know, we talked about politics as a lagging indicator of where America is headed, and I think, you know, that's part of what we're seeing here. I think you're absolutely right, Catherine.
To enrich perhaps Catherine's timeline, and also just to give a hat tip, a lot of this kind of began in 2016 in June and July with Gretchen Carlson's initial accusations against then alive Fox News president Roger Ailes, which was greeted with a lot of skepticism in the Fox building to begin with, but that kind of began to unravel this kind of culture of nastiness that had persisted there, and now that we're seeing it definitely exists across the street over at 30 Rock as well. And the other thing I would just add to that, the January or the early Trump kind of rallies, to me, one of the shining moments of activism, probably the shiniest in my estimation, was during Trump's first ham-fisted travel ban, in which people who had left the country just to travel perfectly legally and were coming back on flights, and suddenly they weren't allowed to disembark in American airports. It was just an awfully inhumane activity by the Trump administration. There was a sudden boom of activism and legal aid groups springing up like pop-up stores almost in all of the nation's airports. It was a really kind of remarkable thing to see. Suderman, story of the year, 2017. We've talked a lot about Trump. You got anything not necessarily 1,000% Trump-related?
The Trump presidency is obviously the biggest story of the year, but I really think that in many ways the equally sort of large politics story is Congress. And, you know, the trials and tribulations of the healthcare bill and the tax bill, which has basically passed, although it might not technically be signed into law until next year in order to help delay some of the automatic Medicare cuts and other things that are sort of that will come as a result of this, except they won't actually come because no one in Congress is going to let them. And so, you know, the whole year in Congress was supposed to be, they were supposed to have all of this stuff done by August, right? In January, Paul Ryan was like, we're going to pass revenue neutral tax reform, repeal Obamacare, and fund a border wall by August. And then we got to August, and they hadn't done any of it. The healthcare bill completely crashed. There was no tax reform plan to be seen at all. And somehow or another, by the end of the year, they got together and figured out how to write a tax bill that was also, at least a little bit, a healthcare bill because it repeals the individual mandate. And it is, I think the reactions on both from backers and from critics have been in a lot of ways overblown to the tax bill, but it is a pretty consequential piece of legislation. Like I've said before here, I have really mixed feelings about it. On balance, I'm probably a little more against it than for it, but I can totally see why someone would support it, and I think there are good things that will come from it. And so, you know, this to me is sort of an interesting story, and there's an interesting meta story surrounding this, which is that which is kind of related to the media coverage, but also to Republicans themselves, who have passed a major piece of legislation for the first time in over a decade. And this is just something that we've kind of forgotten as a nation, as people who follow politics, as a political class, right? Republicans themselves had kind of forgotten what it was like to pass a big bill.
I think
bill.
You're forgetting TARP in your tally, like, Peter, in
That was
2008.
It was about a decade ago. But even still, right, that was a quickie measure that popped up at the very last minute rather than, you know, a major goal of the party that they'd been working on for forever. And so this is I really don't love the way in which it was passed. On the other hand, it is something that sort of points towards a future in which Republicans perhaps start legislating again, maybe.
God help us. Nicholas John Gillespie, story of 2017, besides Peter Suderman's bizarre late breaking optimism about the Republican Party.
Yeah, if I can.
It's not that optimistic.
And
I think this
is a good time to, just to pat myself on the back, because I took a huge amount of shit from people for saying that, you know, at the beginning that Trump wasn't the worst thing that ever happened. And, you know, again, that's not an approval of him, but that it's a mixed bag and there's stuff we can work with, which builds into, my story of the year. And actually, I do think that what Catherine is talking about, the kind of massive societal shift in an understanding of what women go through in the workplace, is the long-lasting thing. And just as, you know, in the end, the social movements of the 60s and the social movements in any period ultimately dwarf the political movements, I think, that's the keeper. But the deregulation that is happening under Donald Trump is huge. And it is, you know, we saw most of the anger and the hysteria, the absolute Y2K level hysteria over the repeal of the Open Internet Order of 2015 or of net neutrality. We've seen that go nuts. This is a reminder that deregulation is happening, and that a lot of this stuff is stuff that was kind of put into place towards the end of Barack Obama's administration through executive order or through bureaucratic fiat, the administrative state, which means, to tie it into Peter's point, it is subject to change depending on who is in office. And it's time, you know, the second step of it, deregulation in general is good, especially if it's done properly, which means that the government gets out of telling businesses and people how to live their lives. But then those businesses and those people are responsible for their choices. No fake bank deregulation where you can become bigger and bigger and get bailed out by the government. None of that, please. But there is deregulation happening, and it is calling forth reactionary, you know, venom that is kind of important to focus on and to recognize that this is just bizarre rage about changing anything, even if it was just something that went into effect a couple of years ago. But then the bigger story, and this ties into Peter's point, is that, you know, Congress should be writing the rules, like not the final detailed rules, but like, does the FCC actually have a mandate to regulate internet service providers? That is not something that should be settled in the courts. It is something that should be settled by Congress. And they can write legislation that actually binds federal agencies in a way that is clear and compelling and meaningful. And that's where that first step should be taken. And then it can go to the courts if it oversteps basic rights that individuals and businesses have. So deregulation.
Yeah. Just to amplify those comments, a lot of what's happening right now is a regulatory slowdown, and it's a massive one, much bigger than expected. And a lot of it is due to what I thought or worried was a gimmicky, we got to kill two regulations for every one. It was assigned in by executive order by President Trump early on. But apparently that had teeth, as did the no net new regulatory costs executive order here, by all accounts. But it is true that real deregulation has to come from Congress. They have to unpass or get rid of some existing laws from which the sort of superstructure of regulation happens. There's been a couple of movements there, but it hasn't really crystallized into anything. And as both the president and Republicans writ large have pretty abysmal approval ratings right now. It's unclear how much Republicans in Congress are going to take that mantle. Here's hoping that they do and you know, see that there's been some positive knock-ons with the existing regulatory slowdowns and peel backs out there. I will just throw quickly my story of 2017. It's maybe more of a frame than anything else, but it's the parable of the boy who cried wolf. And I just would remind everybody that the point of the story is not that there isn't a wolf.
So it's that you can't cry wolf in a crowded theater.
You can cry wolf in a crowded theater. No, it's
particularly
it's
if you're in the theater to watch the Farley Boat movie, inspired movie, Cry Wolf.
You can't say things to wolves that incite them to violence.
Okay, well, what if you're watching that Jack Nicholson movie where he turns into a werewolf?
I believe that was called Wolf.
Like an editor?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like a book editor because guess what, guys? Publishing, it's basically like an animal.
You know, I feel even though Matt is literally recycling stuff I heard him say on the TV last night. Go ahead,
Matt.
That's
true.
What, so listen, the point is that there are wolves or that there are sheep?
No, that there are town criers at the outside of the village who are losing their credibility by the minute with saying that each new thing that the team they don't like does is going to kill people, as Remy put memorably in one of the better recent TV videos of the last year.
They're all change. Better. They're all better. They're all equally beautiful.
Thank you.
Nick loves all his children.
No, but there's a meta story about the way that people view politics. The one thing that's knitting together the Republican coalition right now is an absolute animus towards the media. They got nothing else in common except maybe most of them are pro-life. But for the most part, they just hate the media. And part of it is that they see the media being the people who are crying wolf all the time, which the media are doing because they're in this kind of frenzy. So it I think defines politics and you know, Trump is the wolf in this picture. But by seeing him as uniformly all the time, not just negative, but malintended and just ready to rip out the throats of everybody on every single issue, it's really, really difficult to maintain sanity and to try to judge things on an individual basis there when the culture just wants this constant sort of war or framing out there. And that is going to be with us, especially as the Russia investigation spills out into something concrete beginning in 2018. But we're still on 2017. So I want undercovered stories, stories that people weren't talking about as much as they should have in 2017, but that were nonetheless interesting. Catherine, what do you got?
I think that the most undercover story of 2017 is the most undercovered story of every year, which is everything that is not U.S. politics, and especially all the foreigners who are dead all around the world. Really horrible shit happening. You know, we've got genocide in Myanmar. We've got civil war in South Sudan. We've got Yemen 3 years into a disaster. Headline today, 1 million cases of cholera in Yemen. Now, this is not a fun answer to this question, and for that, I am sorry. But, you know, it's I think, ties into Matt's answer of everyone is totally freaking hysterical about net neutrality in the United States because people will die. Meanwhile, people are dying. Sorry, everybody. That's my story.
That's pleasant. Suderman?
Wow. My undercovered story this year is actually a tech story, and it's the rise of streaming music services and the likely end of digital downloads. So there's a bunch of reporting that Apple, which ran, as you recall, the sort of first big online music store where you would just download a song for 99 cents or so, Apple is reportedly going to stop allowing downloads starting in 2019 and switch everyone over to their streaming service, Apple Music. Now, Apple, to be clear, denies this, but you combine this with the huge, huge sort of adoption of services like Spotify, like Apple Music, like Tidal, which is sort of the audio nerds version of this, kind of partially run by Kanye West and Jay-Z. And it's really interesting. It is putting the music industry back on track to be even more profitable than it was at its CD sales-driven peak in the 90s. And there's a Goldman Sachs report that basically says that it's going to blow through its previous cap over about the next decade or so. You've got something like 30 million subscribers for Apple, 60 million for Spotify, 1.3 billion people listening to streaming music on YouTube. And it's really, it's kind of an incredible shift for an industry that looked down and out and basically like, you know, and many people thought it was just going to kind of collapse. If you go back to about 2008, 2009, sort of in the doldrums. And it really looks like it's picking up again because they have adopted a completely new business model. Now, there's problems with this that have to be worked out, of course. There are, you know, in terms of paying artists and royalties. But in many ways, we're going back. We are sort of going back to a kind of radio-driven format where a lot where playlists end up being really big drivers of singles and of new artists. Curated playlists and end up being basically like radio shows were in the big markets back in the 70s and the 80s. And it's just a kind of fascinating story of technological, business, and cultural change. And, you know, really kind of reveals the ways in which people who are like, well, this old model isn't working anymore. That must be it. It's all over. Everything's done for. No more music. Those people are often wrong and kind of don't foresee what the future is going to look like and what it's going to bring.
In the thumbnail, Peter, it is the money now flowing to the streamers themselves instead of the record companies. How does the, I mean, if the money, the pot of money is growing here, how's the distribution changed? You mentioned artists there as being kind
of... Yeah, so the distribution change is a real issue that's going to have to be worked out because the very, very big artists are doing very well. But the kind of small, the folks we would have thought of as like not quite selling gold, you know, albums, but like they're kind of on the charts back in the 80s, folks like that, their revenues from streaming are not high and they're complaining about this. However, I mean, so just to kind of bring this to another weird cultural story, we have seen like a kind of a strange backlash in the world of online video games in the last couple of months. Basically, I won't go into all the details, but with a couple of games, video gamers are saying, well, the rewards systems, all like the points that you get for playing these video games, they're screwed up and you're cheating us. It's basically a labor revolt against the video game makers by players because playing video games is like a job. And so I think that, you know, these things end up getting worked out, not always without some mess and without some fuss and fight, but these things end up getting worked out between the market players, because in the end, the studios and the streamers can't make money without music. And they have to, and part of the appeal is not just having the new Taylor Swift or the new Drake album, it is having the giant back catalog. And that is also, I think, why 2017 is really such an amazing year to be a music listener. I have started, in particular, going back through a lot of the catalogs of artists from the 60s and 70s, just because it's all there for 10 bucks a month or whatever, right? And in a way that just that didn't exist even at like the peak of kind of Napster pirated download period, you know, in the early aughts, we just have access to everything in pretty good quality now. You know, that and it's kind of amazing, just sort of your ability to be able to go through that and master large bodies of cultural history that didn't exist a decade ago.
Nick,
yeah, if I can very quickly to add on to Peter's, you know, I think it's worth suggesting, especially because I know we have at least a couple of Apple nerds on this podcast, but Apple is like the New York Times. It's where trends go to die. They get certified and consolidated, and it will be a failure. Peter, I agree with you that streaming is the joint. And it's streaming everything is the new cheap CDs or, you know, $5 movies and things like that, or you know, taper culture, you know, on super steroids. And it's great to see the dematerialization of cultural exchange where you don't have to buy a book or an album or anything like that. And I would also point people to services like SoundCloud, where you're seeing a lot of regional artists really break big or reach an audience without record labels for the dispersal of record labels. I think it will be a, I think it will be a loss if Apple gets to, you know, actually control distribution in many ways, because Apple acts like old record companies. It's like Columbia Records in 1970 or something. But be that as it may, I think you're right, and I hope that it is more artist driven and actually user driven, which I think it will be to a certain degree.
Well, just, you know, note that Apple's service is the second place service and is really getting creamed
right.
by Spotify.
Partly because it's free and because that, it is streaming. I mean, Spotify and Amazon Music as well, like the free version of Amazon Music, if you have Prime, is pretty damn good. It's not as deep as Spotify, but it is amazing. And this, you know, to get to your larger point, and especially about these cultural shifts, when you have the ability to watch old culture. I mean, it is, you know, like when you go back and you look at the Middle Ages, you know, which were not the Dark Ages or whatever, but like, you know, Europe knew the Romans, but they didn't really know the Greeks. And when you know, Chapman's Homer became a bestseller in early 19th century England, it changed the way that people could conceive of themselves in the present. And I think you're right. You know, when musicians can easily access everything in the recorded period going back to the 20s or 30s through now, it's fantastic. And a lot of that is unauthorized. And I hope that law doesn't catch up to clamping down on this stuff. This is where, you know, we do need changes in copyright law, and we do need to have a more open commons, of particularly of orphaned works. But it is a game changer, and it will allow people to situate themselves more fully, to create what Van Wyck Brooks, a literary critic, called a usable past. Like, we are all now so much more in control of who we think we came from. Who are our ancestors? Who are our grandparents? Who authorizes us in the current day to live the way that we want and to think about how we want to live? It's extremely exciting.
I would just add that in addition to the mass adoption of these services, we're starting to see kind of niche versions of them pop up. And I would specifically point to Tidal. One of the big criticisms of streaming has always been that the sound quality is not that great. Spotify's has gotten better over the years, but it's still it's a pretty good MP3. Tidal is pitching itself at like serious audio nerds who have the equipment to make, you know, to be able to hear fine distinctions. And I was pretty skeptical. I signed up for a free trial a couple months ago, and I was kind of like, wow, it's actually sounds much better. Now, the interface is also crap, and it has connection problems that Spotify just doesn't have. But their super high quality, master audio quality recordings sound much better, sound as close to a kind of vinyl sound as I've ever heard from digital. And so even if you don't care about like all the audio nerd stuff, this is a good and interesting development, just in that different services are popping up with different pricing models, trying to appeal to different types of audiences and different wants from different audiences. And so that sort of competition is, I think, really it's very good for consumers.
And to put a bow on that, this is effectively the year that Rolling Stone, which was the music bible, you know, since it started in 1967, died. It died on the loss of credibility journalistically because of its a campus rape story, which was revealed to be completely fabulistic. But it also was sold. Jan Wenner is out of the business. And it's kind of a nice handoff, because Rolling Stone has been very, you know, they had trouble with Napster because it threatened the status quo, which the magazine and the music industry was built on a few players having nearly absolute control over both what listeners could listen to, but what artists could do. So it's a kind of nice synchronicity that as Rolling Stone is kind of going into a dotage, at the very least, if not an actual grave, as a meaningful publication, you know, you see a whole new music industry that is much more participatory and is much more fan-focused, consumer-focused, and in many ways artist-focused. These are the types of things that I think we need to be looking forward to and understanding what's going on, because it not only does it temper the bad stuff, you know, and we do see in politics, you know, just it's a horrible moment in American politics, but it cannot, and that's one of the reasons it can't be the limit of our experience. Matt, what I was going to say is, as the undercovered story, is energy prices in the United States. We have achieved, with virtually no fanfare, certainly no parades or anything, we have achieved essentially energy independence in North America. And we have done that over the howls of people. Remember when people were talking about peak oil just a few years ago and that, you know, it was done and energy prices were going to go sky high, or that fracking, you know, was an unproven technology that was going to despoil all of the water in the world, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And we have actually, energy prices and global energy prices are so low that we can actually get on with what we use fuel to do rather than worrying about that. And that is huge. And it's not quite limitless, and kind of cheap and free renewable energy is still a way off in the future. But the situation has improved so much that we are now not, you know, we are less likely to go to war in the Middle East over oil. Saudi Arabia is going through a coup right now, and there are different ways to look at what's happening. But one of the things that is definitely happening is that oil is becoming less of a dictator of foreign policy and of international policy. Venezuela is in receivership finally because of socialism that was built on a single product, a single commodity, oil, which has gone bust and will always go bust. And to, you know, I think it was 1962 when Students for a Democratic Society and Young Americans for Freedom, the right-wing conservative version that Bill Buckley and Stan Evans and a couple of people put together, they both issued their you know, manifestos. And each of them in the early 60s, and this was, you know, the front end of the baby boom, they took as a starting point that by the end of the 60s, we would have free and ubiquitous pollution-free energy from nuclear power. That's what, you know, that's what they were betting on. We haven't achieved that, but we've achieved something very similar. And when you no longer are worried about gas and oil and electricity costs, all sorts of fascinating stuff happens, including stuff like Bitcoin. And, you know, this is a story that we should acknowledge and be grateful for and make sure we don't screw that up.
And part of that, too, is that with the rise of natural gas, hydraulic fracturing, carbon emissions in the United States have been going down steadily. It's the biggest single cause of the thing that people have been most worried about or alarmist about. It's getting better because of the technology that many of them opposed. And I think that's all to the good. Less carbon, less pollution. It proves, or it illustrates at least, the kind of Kuznets curve of the more prosperous you get, actually the cleaner you get, which is a lesson Ron Bailey teaches us constantly at Reason, but which still is shown as a revelation when demonstrated to the outside world. My undercover story of 2017 is going to sound like I'm trying to refute Catherine, and I'm not, because Catherine's right. We're in the midst of four famines and the worldwide peak of refugees at a time when America is taking fewer almost than it has in any other time in the last 40 years. And there's a whole lot that's just awful about that. However, in a Hulk Bruce Banner type way, I started off this year by bemoaning the end of the neoliberal era, by which I mean the post-World War II era of constantly reducing barriers to international trade and an increase of prosperity and more people coming out of extreme poverty in the last 25, 30 years than we've ever seen before. Even with the rise of not just Donald Trump, but Trumpism or even National Frontism, this kind of anti-trade nationalist movements that are happening all over the world right now, even with all that and even just with our own trade policy in the United States, turns out that kind of post-World War II order is maybe more resilient than we thought. We haven't yet totally started ripping up NAFTA. I'm sure President Trump would love to see that happen, but it's hard to actually do all of that. We saw the election of Emmanuel Macron in France, who's basically a neoliberal's neoliberal. And even though he immediately, like all French presidents, suffered a massive hit to his popularity, he is engaging in some kind of reforms, and he's sticking up for that kind of order. Hopefully, and what we've seen throughout 2017, too, is that that machine, that global machine outside of what our parochial interests are, keeps on taking people out of extreme poverty. People keep on forging trade deals just without the U.S. in them, maybe going forward. So I'm a little bit more optimistic about that. And like every single year, That kind of mutual prosperity and people in faraway places getting better off is always undercovered because we always look at our own navels and see all the lint. So with that beautiful transition, let's get into Festivus here. The airing of the grievances. Nick, since you are Johnny Seinfeld on this podcast, why don't we start with you? Who deserves our grievances for their behavior in the past 12 months, sir?
You know, my main grievance has to do with Congress, probably, because I think, they have been failing to do their job for the entire 21st century. They were rubber stamping a bunch of stuff that George Bush pushed through when the Democrats were in power. Obama and the leadership had to twist a lot of arms to get Obamacare passed, but they did it. And now, the Republicans, as Peter was pointing out, other than the tax bill, which is gigantic, whether it's good or whether you think it's good or bad, it's huge. But Congress has manifestly failed to do its constitutionally appointed duties. And I think it's reaching a point where they really can't get much lower in terms of approval. And, so there's that. I think that's for me, I'll keep it simple. It's at Congress, and what I look forward to in 2018 as something that really needs to be contained or reversed is the idea of some of the stuff that you were talking about, Matt. First is spending. We're already getting mixed messages. Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, has said there's no way we're doing anything about entitlements in the coming year. Paul Ryan has said now that the tax bill is passed, we can finally start going after Medicare and Social Security, which would be nice. I don't expect any spending cuts from this government, from this Republican government. But we have to hold their ankles, and dangle them out the window on that. And the larger issue that you were talking about, Matt, this globalist versus nationalist kind of sensibility. If for those of us who consider ourselves more on the globalist side, believing that you, of course, you are a citizen of a particular place, you are a child of a particular region, a particular area, that matters. Local difference matters and different people have different customs. But to pretend that that somehow puts you at odds with a kind of enlightenment understanding of universal rights, of individual autonomy and self-determination, when it comes to things like trade, when it especially comes to things like immigration and freedom of movement and freedom of speech, that is a big challenge. And what I think it's going to take for libertarians is to understand that the old categories that the libertarian movement was forged in, which were effectively Cold War categories, those categories do not exist anymore, and we need to start finding and building different alliances. And Matt, to put a plug in for the Declaration of Independence, our book subtitled "How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America," actually mainline, one of the things that.
I've been drinking this whole time. Was I supposed
to
wait?
You're streaming, no. Peter. Streaming, drinking is a form of streaming, I believe. But it's, we need to figure out alliances, and they're going to be more ad hoc so that, there will be times on the left where we have clear overlapping alliances. And when it comes to things like criminal justice reform, when it comes to things like scaling down the war on drugs, certain elements of free speech and a fairdom and a freedom of opportunity or some level of guaranteed opportunity, if not outcome. And we're going to be finding alliances on the right, but it's a very different world now. And I think the world is more libertarian than it has been in a long time. There are setbacks here and there, but we need to be bold in forging new alliances and making our sensibility kind of like energy prices, more ubiquitous and powering what other people are doing independent of their ideological perspectives.
Catherine, your sensibility is like an energy crisis. What is your
grievance?
It's the grievance?
3 Mile Island of reason.
What are your grievances of 2017?
Again, so much with the sweet talking on this podcast. Right. So clearly Festivus is supposed to be about petty garbage, right? So my grievance is very specific and petty, which is rich people that say they don't want the tax cut, right? And that's a thing that we're now having a little spike of. In my Twitter feed this week, Terry McGlynn, who says, I don't want a tax cut. I want maintained bridges. I want less infant mortality. I want well-paid teachers. I want federally funded science, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want a tax cut. 82,000 likes on that garbage. Screw these people. That is the same thing as saying, I want jelly beans for everyone and cookies for everyone and liverwurst sandwiches for everyone, and I am willing to pay $1 of the $1,000 that will cost. Screw you. That is not how it works. And your social signaling makes me want to barf on you.
Does anyone actually want the liverwurst sandwiches?
That's the point. That's exactly my metaphor. Do you see how my metaphor worked? People want to force other people to pay for things that those people don't even
I'll
want.
Just add,
my metaphor is brilliant.
I'll just add, as Peter looks for the microphone, I will add that the great baseball writer Bill James, who also gets mentioned in our book, Nick, if I'm not mistaken.
Which book is
drink.
That, Matt?
Yeah, that's right. He responded to that very tweet with a great tweet of his own, which is, well, aren't you special?
Liverwurst sandwiches, nothing. Particularly on a nice slice of rye bread with some mustard and maybe a little bit of raw onion, is a delicious treat. And I say that as somebody who doesn't even eat anymore.
Century.
Nick is right about this. Nick is totally right. Liverwurst sandwiches are actually delicious, but we shouldn't buy them with our tax dollars.
Suderman, air your grievances.
The libertarian with weird sandwich tastes.
Guys, I'm going to have to get into some Star Wars spoilers for this.
God damn it.
So, sorry if you haven't done your jobs yet and seen the freaking Star Wars movie, but Luke dies at the end in the dumbest and most pointless death you can imagine. What is that? Like, why would you kill Luke Skywalker off? The whole Star Wars thing is about Luke and his dad and their...
Peter.
It's just about Skywalker.
Get over it, Peter.
And
that's
Luke,
the
Mark Hamill turns in the best non-Joker voice performance of his life, because yes, Mark Hamill's the voice of the Joker in the only Batman cartoon that matters, and he at the very end he like takes on Kylo Ren and like distracts the First Order Empire, which is the same thing because they didn't even bother to like really do anything to rename the old antagonist protagonist relationship, and he does this, and then the big reveal is, wait, he's not actually there, he's astral form Luke still sitting on his island. Why did, and he just like died from overexertion of the force because it was so difficult.
What is
to, like,
wait,
yoga
Peter,
himself
Andy
into
Levy
battle?
Was right.
Are you some kind of royalist where it's not a, you know, if Star Wars is simply about the Skywalker family, why the fuck should I care? The whole thing is that it's starting.
I'm not saying don't kill him.
No, but
period.
I'm saying that
I'm
the
saying,
whole
give him a good and meaningful death.
No,
he's Luke's guy, and they killed Admiral Akbar.
Jesus,
pointlessly off screen.
You know what?
Pointless, entirely
it's a trap.
Pointlessly.
It is a trap.
Yeah. You know, this podcast.
I told you,
was a trap.
This was coming.
I think you're reading it wrong, and that this is what the promise of the new Star Wars is, that it finally, it's not about, you know, it's not simply about a particular family or a particular lineage. And, you know, obviously, you know, the genius of Star Wars is that it was fan participatory. The fans took it over from the creators of it. And if we're being honest, all of the Star Wars movies suck. What is great about them is what it calls forward from fans who created a community and started embroidering on the work, embellishing it, taking the fan fiction movement that really kind of got its feet under Star Trek and blowing it up to a point where George Lucas, who was going nuts trying to shut down everybody who was infringing on his goddamn little copyright, ended up giving up and working with it. Star Wars exists because of people who have nothing to do, who have no right to be producing and creating and interpreting. And I think you see a kind of enactment in the way that the Skywalker storyline is now no longer at the center. It's moved on to a new generation of people who will be doing with it what they want.
Nick, I think you just like made my childhood. My childhood is now worse because of that.
You know what? That's part
I'm,
of.
I
stood out in the rain at the Seaview Square shopping mall in Ocean Township, New Jersey, to see the first Star Wars, and it was like the fifth theater that we had gone to. It was, you know, so don't tell me about Star Wars. I'm like Joe Biden. I know Star Wars, Peter. It ruined my childhood.
Like Joe Biden.
Are we right now doing the podcast equivalent of the feats of strength part of the Festivus celebration in which the head of the household challenges someone to
a lot of problem with you people. Kruger, you couldn't smooth a satin sheet with a hot iron.
My grievance was intended at first to be similar to Nick's in that it was directed at the very kind of Tea Party generation of politicians that came of age in 2009 to 2014, talking about debt and deficits and cutting spending and all of that, and watch them fold like a cheap satin iron blanket as soon as Republicans retook power. But I'm going to just faint in that direction and redirect my grievances at Peter Suderman for absolutely ruining my Star Wars watching, which is going to happen tomorrow with my 9-year-old. My God, sir. Have a kid.
Seven possible days.
See what that's like, bro. My God, you don't have to. You didn't have to wait a week to take your dog to see the damn movie, man.
I really do wish
he's going to see it on video on demand, and he's pretty excited.
I really
about
do wish that Star Wars had more of a sense of humor. You know, it is like a almost completely humorless franchise, but like Admiral Ackbar should have been where, you know, some villains. He's taking a bath, and they turn up the heat, and they boil him or sous vide him to death. I think that would be nice.
So this is. I think this gets us back, though, to the thing we discussed last week about whether Star Wars has replaced religion as kind of our national unifying myth. And in particular, I saw a story this week about a dying man whose last wish was to see the new Star Wars movie. And they like somehow brought it to his hospice room or something. So, you know, this is your religion can't have a lot of self-awareness and irony in it, or it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's probably true.
The new one does have more humor.
Let's bounce out here as we are playing with house money.
So if I could wait, can I just add that? So Peter started 2017 as an Ewok, but he ended it as a barbecued pork.
I want John McLaughlin style 2018 predictions. The more frivolous, the better. Here from all of us before we peace out. I will begin to set the tone, which is that in 2018 the aliens will finally come. I think they're kind of here already, and that the simulation will be revealed, and we'll all be Philip K. Dick. Catherine, what's your prediction for 2018?
I was pretty frivolous for the rest of this podcast, so I'm going to be a teeny bit serious and say my prediction for 2018, a hopeful one, is that checks and balances will continue to function. The various parts of our government will keep the other various parts more or less in check, and we will find ourselves ish in the same place at the end of next year that we are now, which is discontented but still basically functional.
So you're saying it's a new hope?
Shut up.
Peter?
I think the Empire is going to strike back in 2018 because Democrats have an 18-point generic advantage going into the midterm elections here. And I think Democrats are going to probably – they're going to do very well in both the House and the Senate and possibly take back both chambers of Congress.
Yeah, I think you're right. Nick, what is your prediction for 2018?
Because you said to be frivolous, I will tell you that I will find happiness once I get my meds right.
Wow.
Wow.
Literally everyone on the planet is dying. And also...
Nick will find happiness once he gets his meds right.
This
I'm just looking for some justice in this damn war.
I think that is a great way to...
This is an extremely good simulation we've been living in, or maybe not.
We started this podcast as Cindy Lou Who, and we're ending it as a crucified Luke Skywalker in the desert alone. So thank you for listening all year long. And all next year too, as well, to the Reason podcast. Please write us your annual review over there on iTunes. Subscribe, rate us, and all of that. And be ready for an amped up 2018, an expanded universe, if you will, of Reason podcasts. For the other three losers on this show, I am loser Matt Welch, and goodbye.